front of a record electric crowd at Condra Ballpark, the Florida Gators have officially made the College World Series for the first time since 2018. We'll recap it all here tonight on the In All Kinds of Weather forecast. Good evening, everybody. I am your host, Chris Yanes, along with my co-host, Neil Shulman, and welcome in to this episode of the In All Kinds of Weather forecast, where we're going to be getting into all of the excitement where the Gators have finally clinched the College World Series for the first time in five seasons. We're going to be recapping what happened this past weekend and then get into some recruiting news, both basketball and football related, and we'll talk all about what it means for all three respective major programs. But before we do that, a quick read from our sponsor. The In All Kinds of Weather forecast is proudly sponsored by Stingray Branding. These folks will put a sting into your marketing and will deliver results that will wow your clients. Whether it's web design, logo design, branding, graphic design, social media management, search engine optimization, marketing strategy, or mobile app design, Stingray Branding has you covered. If you or someone you know needs professional help in any of the above, here are three great reasons why you should choose Stingray Branding. One, it's a veteran-owned business. Can't think of a better way to properly thank those who serve our country than by giving them business. Two, it's run by a UF alum and big Gator fan. And three, they've got the personal stamp of approval from In All Kinds of Weather, as they did our new logo, our new website, they did the Gator Good Foundation website, and they do all marketing for the Charleston Gator Club, and they've got more Gator-related projects on the horizon. So if you're listening to this pod and your brand or company needs any help in the aforementioned areas, rest assured that Stingray Branding will more than take care of you. To view their full list of services and rates, go to stingraybranding.com. And with that, Neil, welcome in, welcome back, or like I said, welcome home. You did a lot of traveling this weekend to and from Gainesville, where the Florida Gators have made the College World Series. And it was certainly an exciting weekend. The Florida Gators swept the South Carolina Gamecocks in the Super Regional, one of the few Super Regional matchups where that actually did occur. And I believe Florida Gators were one of the first teams to actually punch their ticket on Saturday night. So all very exciting and in front of the two largest crowds, not just in the history of the University of Florida, but in any college baseball program in the state of Florida. So over 8,400 on Friday night, 8,500 on Saturday night. The atmosphere was truly electric. I was watching from TV, could tell from there. But Neil, talk about the atmosphere in Condra Ballpark, what it was like to be there and witness it firsthand.
Special. It was special. The analogy I've given a few friends from up north, a couple of Yankees, Mets, Red Sox, sort of Phillies fans from my area, New Jersey, that's what it was like. The analogy I give them is, imagine if your team, whether it's the Yankees, Red Sox, Mets, or Phillies, were in the playoffs, in the MLB postseason, but they could not play their postseason game in their home stadium because, let's say, like the Canadian wildfires that we've been hearing about were affecting the atmosphere and just completely ruining any opportunity to do anything outside in the Northeast. So you have to just transplant them all down south. And you have to put like a Yankees Red Sox game in Condra Ballpark. And whatever fans you can force in there, you know, you get. So imagine the intensity of, you know, Yankees Red Sox or Phillies Mets in the postseason, but with the, you know, with 8,400 or 8,800 fans in there. It was loud. It was rowdy. The Carolina fans were quite outnumbered, but they, you know, they contributed to that loudness. But the Florida fans, I mean, they know what it takes to be a true advantage. They do it in football. They did it in basketball before, you know, the program kind of petered out there for a little bit, but I mean, the Gator fans know what it's like to be part of a big time atmosphere. They've done it in the Swamp for decades now, and they brought that same intensity to the baseball. So, you know, Florida had a real advantage. I don't know that this game is in Columbia or even in a neutral field. I don't know that Florida wins the series. They might have, they might not have, but there is something to be said about the advantage that Florida had from playing in front of its home crowd. And it was pretty decisive. Of an advantage.
Yeah, it definitely appeared so. And you know, just looking at game by game now, game one, Friday night, it was a late start due to the weather. Both games were a late start due to the weather. And the crowd was just into it from the get-go. Florida got off to a decent start, but they did fall behind South Carolina in the game. They were down 3-2. But I don't know, Neil, just from my perspective watching, it just felt like we were never really out of it in that game. It felt like the crowd could propel them. Brandon Sproat threw some really good innings there, kept it knotted up until the bats got going for the Gators later in the game to separate themselves and get that two-run lead. And then on Sunday, or on Saturday, rather, it just felt like Florida could not lose. They could not do anything wrong. Yes, the umpire, though there was some controversy amongst the South Carolina fans with the umpire. Yes, the umpire called an inconsistent game both ways, mind you, both ways. I think the difference, though, for Florida was the timely hitting and just the crowd. I mean, we said it when we interviewed Chris from the Spurs Up show last week. If this game were in Columbia, South Carolina, like you mentioned, this series probably goes the other direction. These teams were very well matched. I do think Florida was the more talented team, and I think the depth of the pitching came through this week. Like we did talk about, that pitching was the major key. Who could pitch better, who could be more consistent, and Florida was just more consistent on the mound. They got the timely hits when they needed them, and they just made plays when it mattered, and that's what championship teams do, and Florida did that in this series. So Neil, let's go ahead and recap game one, kind of talk, lead us, our fans, through what, you know, your analysis of that and what it meant. I kind of brushed over both games really quick, but give your analysis of game one.
Yeah, well, I think it has to start with somewhat of an undercard theme that we've seen this year. It doesn't get all the ink, it doesn't get all the tweets about it, but something that I think Gator fans should remember about this season is that Brandon Sproat has developed a habit of getting off to a bad start, but then settling in, somehow just flipping a switch and just completely shutting the other team down. The bomb that Will McGillis hit on the first batter of the game was one of the farthest I've ever seen a baseball get hit. Obviously, there's aluminum bats in play versus the wood bats that I've watched all the MLB games with. But that thing was absolutely rocketed. Actually, Yohandy Morales hit another one from Miami. I think that was maybe a little farther. But this one was just, it could not possibly have been barreled up any more perfectly. So that's a bad pitch. And he made a couple more bad pitches, because three of South Carolina's four hits in the first inning were just complete barrel up jobs. They did what they're supposed to do as hitters. We talked about this on the show before, but how, you know, you can't always control everything. Baseball is weird. You can smoke a ball right at the third baseman and just, you know, top one and get like a swinging bunt single. Well, which one did you do the better job in? The one that wound up a single, or the one where you put the barrel on the ball? So stuff like that can happen. But South Carolina's three of their four hits were smoked. And that's an indication that Sproat wasn't hitting his spots. He was being found out. He was being figured out by the Carolina offense, because they were just touching him up in the first inning and the second inning too. Granted, there was a bit of help that we kind of gave him with a fly ball that got lost in the lights and that wound up being a double. So that goes against Sproat in the hit column. It's not an error because he didn't touch it with his glove, but you know, that didn't help. But he did not get out to a good start because he was missing some of his pitches. You could see he was missing by more than he probably meant to when Ryapel sets off maybe 2 or 3 inches off the plate in hopes of getting a chase or maybe getting a friendly call. He's missing by 4 or 5 inches off the plate, and Ryapel can't frame it and he can't get the strike call. So those kinds of misses combined with the balls that just get smashed were an indication that he did not start off well. But the way he bounces back, there's a saying in baseball that the second or third time through the lineup, the hitters can kind of figure out a pitcher. They kind of figure out what he's doing and get more comfortable hitting against him. But it feels like for Sproat, and thus the hitters get to have more success second or third time through the lineup than they do the first time because they haven't seen it yet. But for Sproat, it feels like he's more successful against batters the second or third time he faces them. He shut them down after the second inning. And he kept Florida in the game. Thankfully, Florida got enough offense. Josh Rivera touching one, putting it over the fence, 2-run home run. Gators got 3 more runs, wound up winning that game 5-4. And if Sproat is not able to regain his form and we don't get the relief pitching that we wind up getting, Carolina wins game one. And, you know, who knows how the next couple of games go. So big, big, big bounce back from Sproat, as he has done all year.
Yeah, most definitely. And it would be nice to see Brandon's purpose settle in a little bit sooner in some of these starts. I mean, he is, for all intents and purposes, the ace of this staff. He's the Friday night or the Thursday night starter, depending on how the season has gone. And he's going to very likely be the starting pitcher Friday night versus Virginia, national seed at number 7. So we're going to need him to have his stuff early on in that game. But nonetheless, like you said, he kept the team in it. He regained his composure, and he allowed Florida to get the offense going just enough and ultimately got the win. And final score, 5-4, Neil. I mean, we said a couple of weeks ago with Shelton and Dave Soderquist that if Florida could maintain and score 5 runs a game and keep the other, you know, score 5 runs or keep a team under 5 runs, that's a recipe for victory. And that's exactly what happened Friday night, and they were able to get the victory. And I think most Gator fans could sense that. I don't want to say this, the series was over or it was a foregone conclusion that Florida was going to win, but as we all talked about, for South Carolina to probably have luck and win this series, they had to win game one. They really had to get off to a hot start, win game one. And I just think the momentum going into game two was almost insurmountable. And it became even more insurmountable with what pretty much became an all-time performance from Hurston Waldrop. So give the fans kind of a taste of what it was like to witness that 13 strikeout performance.
Yeah, I mean, you called Sproat the ace of the staff. I think Waldrop may have something to say about that. I mean, the two are great friends. It's not like it's a competition, but he has made his case for being – I mean, that performance he gave us was one of the great ones in postseason history. I mean, we talked on the last show, too, how Cade Fisher, in a relief pitcher who hadn't gone more than 4 innings all year long, goes 7 and keeps Texas Tech at bay the whole time. This was even better because Waldrop just made them look dumb. That was the thing to me, at least watching in the stands and then confirming it, watching the highlights on YouTube. He made the hitters look stupid, because if you don't really know what you're watching and you watch that game, you watch his slider, his breaking pitch just keep falling off a table, and Carolina hitters keep swinging at it as it keeps tailing away. And you'll think, well, why can't they just hold off? Those pitches are all balls. They're all in the dirt. Why can't they just stop swinging and get balls called? Well, it's not that easy, because they all look like fastballs, but then they just drop off a cliff and you can't help it. You've already started your swing, so you got to just lunge for it. Otherwise, you're just going to get called in a check swing. So he made them look like they didn't know what they were doing. Of course, this is a very strong offense South Carolina has. They've got a lot of great hitters, Ethan Petrie, Will McGillis, Cole Messina among them. But the eye test was passed. And it wasn't just 13 strikeouts because the umpire's zone was terrible, which granted it was, but that's not why. He is an elite pitcher, and he had Carolina just looking absolutely helpless against him. And Florida's offense was not great, I would say. Colby Halter, of all people, deserved to be the guy that gets hailed as the hero coming through with that 2 RBI knock in the second inning, just ripping that one down the right field line. But other than that, other than Josh Rivera finding a hole, Florida's offense really didn't do a whole lot. They scattered some base hits here or there, but you would have to say, Chris, that I don't know that you can say Florida's offense did enough to win the game. The pitching won that game. If you get an average effort from the Florida staff, compiling all the data you've gotten from them all year long, I don't know that 4 runs wins that game. So Hurston Waldrop, the game of his life. Brandon Neely, who, by the way, we didn't even talk about this in the first game recap, but got roughed up for a bomb in the last inning with 2 outs. Bounces back, finishes that game off. Comes back the next day. He did get the save, so it's not like he has a loss to bounce back from, but shakes it off, comes back, and dominates them again the following day to close it out. So good thing the Gators' pitching depth didn't get tested, I think, but it's pretty clear that the Gators' top of their pitching rotation, the guys that they will call upon first, both in terms of starters and relievers, are elite. And that, if the offense picks up, might just be enough.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think just moving forward, we're going to have to see that offense get going. Virginia put up some pretty big numbers offensively this past weekend against Duke. They fell behind, dropped game one. That they could have easily won game one. If anybody didn't see it, Virginia's walk-off home run attempt was robbed at the wall, which would have actually won them the game. And then they absolutely battered Duke in game two by 10 runs. It would have been a 10-run rule had that been in effect. It's not, 10-run rules are not in effect in postseason play for baseball. but we're going to have to get the bats going against a Virginia team that is pretty good. We're going to preview them later this week. But that game is going to be Friday night at 7 o'clock, Neil. Is that correct? 7 o'clock on ESPN. So definitely tune in for that one. But yeah, no, just to really sum up the series, and I'll let you sum up your thoughts too, just going and previewing the College World Series. I think that this team can win in a variety of ways. They proved the NCAA tournament personified that. You look at game one against Florida A&M in the regional. It was a pitching masterpiece by Caglione. And, you know, they won 3-0. Good defense on the field. Great pitching on the mound. They get the victory. Then they fall behind. They lose to Texas Tech in game two. And then they have to get the bats going and rip off three straight games. And they do it. And they do it in emphatic fashion, going on a 21-3 run. Yes, the bullpen. Yes, the quality starts were there for the pitching. But the bats got going. They proved they can win a game by lighting up the scoreboard. And then back here again, super regional, back and forth matchup. They finish the job. They're clutch in big situations in game one. And then in game two, they get timely hits, and then they just have dominant pitching on the mound once again. So I think they've proven, Neil, that they can win in a variety of ways. And that's the recipe for success in Omaha, but they're going to have to just stay consistently consistent. And that's the only way you really win a championship in baseball, in such a fickle sport where little things can go one way or another, and it'll be the ultimate factor in whether you win or lose. So, Neil, go ahead, sum up your thoughts for the Super Regional, and you know, give the fans a little bit of taste of what to expect for the Omaha.
Well, I mean, Chris, you know me, living in South Carolina, the payback was 500 billion chef's kisses at once. I could not possibly have been happier to get that revenge over this team of all others. I'm not going to go and drag their whole fan base again. We've been there, done that. But anyone who follows us or has followed us for a while knows that I don't think very highly of that fan base, and just rubbing it in their faces was just glorious. But I mean, this isn't about that. It's not about my personal disdain for them. It's a baseball team that I think started hot, start the year, mercy ruling Charleston Southern twice, and stayed hot. They had the one bad series against South Carolina. They lost the series to Texas A&M. So this was a team that, other than those games, has started hot, stayed hot, and wire to wire been an elite baseball team. And we didn't see them play their best this weekend, and they still won. That's how you know. It's yes, like you said, winning games in a variety of ways, definitely, absolutely a critical piece to being a championship team. But winning with your B game, you don't have your A game, you're not doing everything the best you possibly can. Winning with your B minus C plus game is how you know, against a good team, mind you, South Carolina, number 15 in the country. That's how you know this team is special. So that's the ultimate takeaway from this weekend, because they didn't play their best. Jack Caglione, the NCAA leader in home runs, didn't hit one this week. Florida got elite pitching, but now, other than Colby Halter with a couple of feel-good hits, the big base knock to get two runs home in the second game, you know, Rivera had some nice hits, but the Gators didn't get the numbers at the plate this weekend that you would have expected them to get. And here they are in the College World Series. So speaking of that, Florida has to be the overwhelming favorite to win its pool. I don't know that you call them the favorite to beat Wake Forest, but Oral Roberts is a 4 seed. I know they've won a lot of games, so you know their record is absolutely impressive, but that's in the Summit where they're playing North Dakota State and South Dakota State. So I don't know how much stock you really put into that.
And they beat an Oregon team that wasn't even a national seed.
Right. Granted, on the road, going on the road and winning a series in the postseason is never easy, but that is an Oregon seed, an Oregon team that I would say is decent, but definitely took advantage of Vanderbilt just flopping at the worst possible time to win that regional. So, but Oral Roberts is not a joke. We remember we saw Coastal Carolina in 2016 win it all. They were not a national seed, although they only had 8, not 16 back then. But, you know, we saw Fresno State in 2008 win it. So it can be done. And Fresno State was a 4 seed then. So it's not like it's completely unprecedented. But from a talent standpoint, it is very clear that Florida has the edge there. So there's that. And, you know, Virginia is a team that, yes, their record is good. Yes, they are in the ACC, but go look a little bit deeper, because they didn't play Wake Forest. They didn't play Clemson. Those are the two best teams in the ACC from a record standpoint. Virginia didn't play either of them this year. So, yeah, their record's good, but they kind of got lucky with their scheduling and still finished third in the ACC. So they're a good team. They definitely have some talent. They definitely have some arms. They can hit the baseball pretty hard. I watched one of their games against Duke. They barreled up a lot of pitches on Duke's number two starter. So that was, you know, they're not a joke. But again, that's another team that you have to think Florida has the natural talent advantage over. And then TCU was another team that, again, is solid, but they were they were kind of close to being on that bubble heading into April and early May. They got hot. They won enough games down the stretch that they were pretty secure, I would say, but they were not a sure thing to make the NCAA tournament for much of the year. They barely finished with a winning record in the Big 12. And they do have some holes, I think, in their lineup that Florida can exploit. So, you know, oh yeah, and they got the advantage of having to host of getting to host a super regional when they were not a national seed because of some complication with the Special Olympics in Terre Haute, Indiana, where Indiana State was supposed to host it, but they didn't. So they did go and they crushed Arkansas twice. But that, I think, if you look at their resume, would be the anomaly. And I'm a big law of averages guy, so I have to say, I know, if you keep putting those two teams out there, I don't think that result keeps repeating itself. So Florida, again, has the talent advantage over them. We'll talk about them in much more detail, obviously, later in the week. But just the way too early brief, like pre-preview of them is that Florida is the most talented team, both in terms of pitching arms, pitching depth, and in terms of bats.
Yeah, definitely. And you look at the other side of the bracket, it's pretty competitive. With you look at a team like Wake Forest. Freudian slip. That is the nickname for the number one seed out there right now. They did defeat Alabama 22-5 in the final super regional game. Pretty impressive victory for them. So they're riding pretty high and hot coming into the College World Series here. But you know, you look at that; those two, LSU and Wake Forest, have to match up in game one against each other. They're arguably two of the hottest teams in the super regional outside of maybe a Florida who swept their regional. So we'll have to see what happens there, but I'm excited. I think this is going to be a great tournament, and Neil, we're going to preview it a lot further as the week goes on. So please be on the lookout for that. So exciting time for.
Wait, no, they don't. No. They're on. No. Wake Forest is going to get the winner of the 8-9 super regional.
Oh, that's right.
They're on the same side. They're going to play probably in the 1-0 game. So yes, one of those teams will knock the other one out before Florida has to deal with them.
Correct. Yeah. So we will not have to face both of them, but at least more than likely one of them. Those two teams seem to be on a collision course. So appreciate the correction on that one. But Neil, baseball's riding high. We're looking good there. That covers one major sport. We're going to cover a second major sport in the Big Three tonight, and that is the basketball program, where Todd Golden, or should we say the Todd Father, has been hot on the recruiting trail, both in the transfer portal and now in the high school ranks. So we're going to cover the transfer portal first and just recap kind of where what he has done to this roster in a matter of months. Neil, we said when the Gators ended their season, Todd Golden had to hit the transfer portal hard. He needed to remake this roster, and he's done that. He was able to keep a star player like Riley Krugel from going into the NBA draft or putting his name out there for maybe entering the G League or something like that. But he's returned to school and will be one of the leaders of the team. And then he went out and has added some incredible guards and then some incredible big man through the portal. So the latest addition, there were two recent additions. The first one is Zion Poulin from UC Riverside. Zion, this will be his final year of eligibility. Neil put out an article kind of talking about what he's capable of doing on our website and allkindsweather.com. But Zion is an 18-4-4 player. This is somebody that projects to potentially be our starting point guard. And, you know, there was a lot of statistical analysis that went out there that even after all the transfers that Todd Golden had pulled in, Florida was flirting with a potential top 20 roster based on analytics and all the metrics out there, how they analyzed that. But when they pulled him in, it elevated us almost to the top 10, in somewhere in between 10 and 15. That's pretty impressive what you think about right there is you're looking at a team that is a potential 4-5 seed in the NCAA tournament based on those analytics. That is the kind of impact both going through the transfer portal and bringing in a player like Zion Pullen has. He finished off the roster makeover with a former player of his own, Julian Rishwane, who is a wing player, projects more as that 2-3 spot. He shoots about 43% from three-point range. And, you know, this is a guy who's not going to start, but is going to be a great player, a spark player off the bench. He even said as much when he transferred into Florida, and certainly already having great prior knowledge of how Todd Golden not just runs a program, but also runs his offense through the various players on the court. This is I think this is a great get for the team, Neil, just by, you know, he's going to be able to impart a lot of wisdom on both the guys that have already played with him for a year and the guys coming in, transferring in, what the system is like and how to run this offense properly. So all in all, Florida has now brought in 6 transfers since the end of the season. They also signed 2 players through the high school ranks, Thomas Hugh, who a top 200 player, a 3-star power forward, and then Alex Condon from the NBA Global Academy out of Australia. He's a 6'10", 230-pound guy. He's a pretty big man there. And then pair that with a guy like Michael Hanglogden, a 7'1" player from Marshall, and then guys like EJ Jarvis and Tyrese Samuel finishing out that front court. So, Neil, kind of give your thoughts on just where you are with Todd Golden, the program, where we're headed. I think Gator fans are starting to see the signs that he's really picking it up. And actually, I forgot to mention one more thing, and I'll finish this up and then I'll let you talk. But we've now pulled in 2 big commitments in the high school ranks. The most recent and the biggest commitment yet for Todd Golden, that is 7-foot-1 center John Bull, a top 30 consensus player who is fringing on a 5-star ranking out of Wichita, Kansas. John Bull, if you look at his film, it's very impressive. John was actually considering going straight to the G League and actually forgoing college. He also had some pretty impressive offers out there as well. But John Bull ultimately decided to come play for Todd Golden and the Florida Gators. And then there's Isaiah Williams, who committed out of the Orlando area a couple of weeks back. So now, and he is a 4-star as well. So now Todd Golden not only has shown the ability to go in the transfer portal and get players over programs like a St. John's, like a Michigan, like a Kansas, like a Gonzaga, he's also now beating some of the same programs for the top talent in the country at the high school level. So check, check, Neil. We're building a roster, and we're getting going here. What do you think of the moves that Todd Golden has made?
Yeah, I mean, I think now we have some semblance of completion to the sentence that we kind of left unfinished with the voice trailing off, which was last year, Todd Golden and the Florida Gators season was kind of shot before it began because they failed to land Jonai Broom. They failed to land Norchad Omir. It was the failure to land those top guys through the portal that kind of doomed them before he started the season. Could they figure that out? Could they do better? Could they learn from their misses? Could they rack in the talent next year? We don't know. We'll have to see ... And then we just left it open. Well, now we have some finality there because I mean, we can start with the transfers that we got. Zion Pullen is a guy that averaged 18.3 points a game last year. Granted, UC Riverside is not in the SEC or the Big Ten, but that's still something that shows that he can score in a variety of ways. You know, he can drive, he can shoot the three ball, he can be productive in other ways, 4.2 assists and 4.4 rebounds per game. You know, he's a versatile player. He adds some depth too. Gators now have a nice 1-2 punch with him and Riley Kugel doing, I would imagine, very similar things in the Florida offense. He's joining a class this year, an influx of talent that's already very impressive. EJ Jarvis, Walter Clayton, Tyrese Samuel, Micah Hanlogton, guys you mentioned. I mean, the team is going to look very, very different next year. And I think the only real loss that is not replaceable is obviously Colin Castleton. Everywhere else, Florida's gotten better, and they've gotten markedly better. And then, you know, landing John Bull himself, a 7-1 guy Golden is not necessarily known for his work with big men. That's why he has assistants to do that for him. I do believe he had a nice assist from his assistants in landing John Bull, but he's the head coach. He absolutely gets credit, and he certainly had a hand in this. So we can go ahead and say that this is the biggest commitment that Todd Golden has gotten ever in terms of a star ranking, in terms of the overall ranking in his class, in terms of the importance of landing the guy that he just landed. Standing 7'1", consensus high four-star prospect, bordering on that five-star, offers from the national champions, Connecticut, from Missouri, which is not a terrible program either, Butler, Kansas State, Texas, Wake Forest, Michigan, Illinois. Those are the pretty good programs. They're not, aside from UConn, they're not really what I'd call blue bloods. Maybe Michigan is, but
they've been more consistent than Florida in basketball recently.
Hey, sure. I mean, you can't argue that point. They're all respectable programs. They are respectable programs that are fairly consistently in the NCAA tournament, with the exception of Wake Forest recently. But these are good programs that Todd Golden landed him over. And that's a big, big, big deal. Because as you said, it's not just the transfer portal that he's having success. And now we're seeing him be able to do it the old-fashioned way, too, through the high school ranks. And that is the best way to get some continuity on the team. The portal, we talked about, that's great. You can build a team for a year, but you're going to land guys who are only going to be there for a year or two before they go elsewhere. They're coming to Florida to bolster their draft stock and or in some cases, as a graduate transfer for only 1 year. High school is where you get guys that you can build a program that's going to play with, that's going to have players that play with each other for 2-3 years at a time. So if he can start landing those types of or that type of talent at all the positions, not just the center position, Florida is going to be in very good hands and be very well set up to be very successful in the years to come.
Agreed. He's going to have to continue to show that ability to pull players from the high school level. But overall, this roster has been remade now in the image of what Todd Golden wants. There is only one projected starter for next year, and that's Will Richard, who's actually left over from the Mike White era. The rest of the players have all only been in the program, starting-wise and main rotation players have only been in the program for a year, and that was Todd Golden's inaugural year with Florida. So you look at it, Neil, this is his team now. This is his squad. That is the beauty of having a small roster like a basketball team. We're able to flip the roster a lot faster, juxtapose with a football team like, you know, Billy Napier's dealing with right now, and we've chronicled. But this is his team. This is going to have all his fingerprints over it. And from here on out, I think he's judged on the players that he has moving forward. So exciting stuff. I think at this point, basketball recruiting is pretty much going to probably take a little bit of a backseat to the rest of the news, but you probably won't hear too much more basketball news from us until the season really gets going or we preview it come fall. But exciting times. I'm really now excited about next season, whereas a couple months ago, I think there was a little bit of unease about how he could deal with this. And you know, you look at the transfer portal, he pretty much got every player he want, with the exception of Tyler Perry, who was a North Texas prospect who ended up choosing Kansas State. But that's really the only guy that he lost in the transfer portal and the recruit that he's lost recently that he truly wanted. So big change from last season for Todd Golden. We will wait to see what he can do in the offseason. All right, so that covers basketball and baseball news. Now we're going to get into the final of the three major sports, and that is football. Billy Napier had another exciting visitors weekend, bringing the total to 30 official visitors over the last 2 weeks. But before we get into that, a quick word from one of our partners, the Gator Good Foundation. It's a nonprofit organization that works to send an underprivileged Gator fan to the swamp. For those of you that are new listeners, the Gator Good Foundation collects donations from fans and uses it to bring someone to his or her first ever Florida Gator football game. You believe you or someone you know is worthy of the honor for next season, please email us at gatorgoodfoundation@gmail.com. All right, Neil, we had another big visitors weekend last week. We had a school record, for at least a record in recent memory, of 17 official visitors. This past week, a little bit lower, but still a pretty big number of 13. And a lot of news is starting to already trickle out from this visitors weekend. You know, we had some pretty big names on there. And I think, last week we had the leader of the class, DJ Lagway, visit us. And then this week we had Miles Graham be the kind of that alpha, that leader in the clubhouse for us this week. So, you know, Neil, we do have some breaking news, though, to report out of this, and that is that Florida has finally landed another commitment, and that is offensive tackle Mike Williams out of Maryland. He was a former South Carolina Gamecock commit who had recently decommitted, visited Florida, and then committed to Florida off his visit this past week. This is the first official offensive line recruit that Florida has gotten, and it gets the ball rolling on that line of scrimmage where we need to start seeing some more trench monsters, both on the offensive and the defensive side of the ball. So what are the Gators getting with Mike Williams? You know, this is a guy that's got a pretty big frame, 6'5", already over 300 pounds, around 310. So he has the ability to continue to fill out that frame and that size with some more muscle and strength as he enters a college program. You know, he's got some quick feet, ability to potentially play the outside at that right tackle or left tackle spot. But, you know, there are some that are saying he could project inside of. He puts on more weight, can be that kind of that road grader in the middle and maul some guys at the guard position. So we'll have to see. I think that, you know, he's a consensus three-star. This isn't a commitment that Florida fans are going to be incredibly excited about, especially on the heels of losing one of our best commits in Chauncey Bowens to our rivals up in Georgia. But Florida did get a commitment from at a position of need, and offensive line is always a position of need. You are always going to have to fill out offensive line. And the majority of offensive linemen who do tend to pan out, they're not always the elite of the elite players. Now, obviously, elite players pan out at a higher percentage than guys that are at Mike Williams' level, but there are not as many 4- and 5-star offensive linemen. And that's really the point I'm trying to make here. You are inevitably going to probably take a 3-star or 2 on the line of scrimmage, and especially at offensive line. And Mike Williams had an impressive offer list. So, you know, Florida beat out South Carolina. We beat out Miami for his commitment. So it's not like, you know, he was a guy that wasn't coveted by other Power 5 programs. But Florida did need to get somebody in this room. They got it. And they have a guy who potentially can have the versatility between playing offensive tackle, offensive guard. So, Neil, really quick, what are your thoughts on the commitment and what it means overall for the recruiting room?
Well, I think if we've learned anything from Billy Napier on the recruiting trail so far, it's that it's not really wise to doubt his takes. He has had several players he's taken who have only risen up through the ranks after committing to Florida. And that's very impressive, because if you look historically, typically the rankings are not very friendly toward Florida Gator commits. They usually do drop them after they're showing serious interest to or committing to Florida. But we saw a guy like Jakeem Jackson last year, completely unrelated story, but we saw him sit there kind of in a low mid 4-star rating. Yeah, you know, good take, good corner, could be a decent player for us. Shoots up the rankings, almost gets that 5th star by the time the recruiting rankings are finalized. And now Gator fans are suddenly looking at him as one of the players they're most excited about. So Mike Williams on the offensive line is not a take I'm upset about. I think it is a good take. You know me and my relationship with Carolina fans. I love, you know, going ha-ha and sticking my tongue out at them. But this is a guy that I think can play for the Florida Gators if he continues to develop a little bit. First run through his tape, I do think he's a little raw, but he is strong and he is pretty smart with his technique. I mean, you can see that. You can see that he does have some intuition, just jumping off the snap and getting his hands in the right place. I think that that's something that not every offensive lineman in high school does that well. They, you know, some of the even really elite ones just rely on pure athleticism and strength to just maul people and bulldoze them over. There's a bit of intelligence you can kind of see in Mike Williams, but at the same time, you know, Chris, we talked about this too off air. Florida does need to start landing some of the elites. And they need to start landing many of them, because this class is going to have to triple in size to be filled out. And we are now in the middle of the month of June. It's not January or February anymore. It's not March anymore. We're getting close to the dead period. And then before you know it, the season will be here. And as we've talked about, the class you have when the season starts is 85%, 90% about what you're going to wind up signing. So we got to start picking it up and we got to start landing more of those elites. I do like the fact that Napier has not, in his year and a half of recruiting for the Florida Gators, he has not to this point reached, he has not taken a, you know, he's not gone down to take a bad take. I think everyone has been quality, but it's not quality over quantity, as we learned with last year's class. You need both. You need quality and quantity. You need a large quantity of quality players. Now, Florida got a good number of them, but they didn't get enough. And now, you know, maybe Mike Williams can develop into something special for the Florida Gators. I think that it's definitely possible with what I saw on his high school tape, but I think that the Gators need to start picking it up. You know, we're talking generally. I think the prompt you actually gave me was give me your thoughts on Mike Jones, but just summing up recruiting a little bit more broadly here, I'm a bit disappointed, quite frankly, that Florida did not finish the deal with a certain linebacker we talked about a couple weeks ago, Chris Jones. You bring mom and dad down to the swamp. You got a visit to Georgia scheduled a couple weeks later. You got a crystal ball into Florida. That's not an accident. There's some real intel there that says he's really, really high on Florida. And obviously he is if he's bringing his parents down. Finish it. Get it over with. Make him close it down and wrap it up. And don't let him walk out of the city of Gainesville without that commitment. And it, look, I understand that there is something to be said about not being the pushy salesman guy. I understand that the genuine nature of Billy Napier does gravitate with a lot of recruits. I understand that they see him as a guy who's real and genuinely out for their best interest and therefore will not push too hard. But I think that there has to come a point where Napier realizes that with some kids, not all of them, but certainly with some recruits, that's going to be what's needed. The line Shelton used when we went on High Top Sport was, well, thanks, coach. I really like Florida, but I'm going to have to think about it. Well, what's there to think about? You're here. Mom's here. Dad's here. What do you have to think about? Do it. You know, get some of these commitments over with and don't let them take those visits to Georgia or other schools. And I think if he does that, if he starts closing on some of these other guys that Florida's got a lot of smoke for, maybe we'll wind up with that top 10 and maybe even top 5 class that I think a lot of Gator fans are saying he has to have this year.
Yeah, and I definitely think that Florida has got to get that top 5 class. I mean, you look at the way, only way we're going to keep up with the Alabamas and the floor and the Georgias of the world is to get those commitments. So we have to get it, and we need to start getting them soon. One commitment that we did get off the visit this week, and we put out an article today chronicling this, but that was Quincy Ivory, who is a JUCO transfer from East Los Angeles College, better known as ELAC, and part of the documentary series on Netflix, Last Chance U, highlighting the basketball program there. He's coming from their football program. And Quincy was originally a quarterback, actually. He played a little bit of both quarterback and edge in JUCO, and which is pretty rare, but he has recently kind of shifted all his focus, packed on a lot of size. He's now up to 6'5", 250 pounds. So a great size for an edge rusher and put up some very impressive statistics. I mean, he had 22 tackles. He had 8 sacks and, you know, double-digit quarterback hurries, a couple of fumble recoveries and forced fumbles. So this is clearly a guy that can get to the quarterback. And if you go in our article on allkindsweather.com, we put a link in the article to his huddle film from this past season. And that was those statistics that I rang off were through 10 games. So he showed an ability to pretty much get a sack every single time he touched the field. You know, and I'm not sure the production level we're going to get out of him. He's not a highly ranked JUCO prospect. He wasn't a highly ranked high school prospect, but clearly showed an ability to play the edge position at the JUCO level for a season. And Florida needs edge players. We don't have a lot of guys really at the edge position. That was a position we failed to get in the address in the transfer portal. We got a couple of guys like a TJ Searcy this past season at the high school ranks. We have Jack Pyburn, the class before that. Two of those guys, I think, are showing a lot of promise and ability. Searcy through his first spring practice, Pyburn through one season of playing on the field and primarily on special teams. I think those are guys that are going to definitely see the field this year, but you need depth in the SEC. Guys get hurt. You need guys with experience to be able to plug in there. Line of scrimmage, you can never have enough at those positions. So, you know, Quincy Ivory, I think it's a decent take at this stage in the game. There aren't a lot of guys out there really for us to take. We had two scholarships left to fill. This gets us now to 84, and we have one more scholarship left to either go out and address it in the transfer portal or award a prefer or a walk-on a scholarship this upcoming season. So I think that all in all, it's a good move for the program, and I don't think it's going to change the trajectory of the team next year. It's not that kind of commitment, but I think nonetheless, it's good to add depth when you can get it.
One thing I'll add though, Chris, is that especially, being so close with James Houston, going through that pre-draft process with him, one thing I heard a lot of from both his agent and from some of the feedback I got from NFL teams asking about him is that sack numbers, regardless of the level of competition, do tend to translate at least to some degree. He left Florida, goes the step down. Well, he's in an HBCU now. He went from the SEC to the SWAC. What is the SWAC? It's just a little FCS conference for, HBCUs. Well, he goes there and gets 16 and a half sacks. And we all saw what he did when he got to the NFL. It took him some time. He had to go to practice squad level. But when he got to the NFL, he got his call up, wound up with 8 sacks in the span of 7 games. So obviously that's one guy. I understand it's anecdotal and not every single player is going to translate like that. But the fact is that a lot of people who know more about the game than I do, than you do, than anyone else does, they all seem to unanimously have this idea that or have data that sack numbers and tackles for loss even do translate when you take a step up, at least to a certain degree. Maybe not, maybe he won't match the sack a game pace, but there's definitely a reason why Florida was interested in him. And they definitely saw an ability in him that he can produce at the SEC level. So definitely not, a 5-star, not a high 4-star. He's not going to be a guy that I think a lot of Gator fans are going to pencil in their starting lineups when it comes time to do that this summer. But definitely also not someone to completely write off either.
Well, and look at what Florida State got in Jared Verse. Jared Verse was a very appreciated player at the FCS level. He came in coming in from Albany, and the only reason they ever found out about him, or any Power 5 school ever found out about him, was because they were scouting Syracuse, who Albany happened to be playing in the season. And then they were like, why is this guy not on a Power 5 program? He's dominating everybody there. He put up giant sack numbers, and then it carried over when he got to Florida State. So another anecdote, a data point there, but you will see if Quincy Ivory could, even come close to that 8 sack number. And if he does, that is going to propel our defense, because last year we only had 23 sacks, which is very low. You really need to get over that 30 number. You need to get to the quarterback. You need to put the pressure on them to force them into mistakes and turnovers, which we just did not do enough last year.
I was going to say, if he gets 2 sacks for the year, that's a great take. Like that's all we need. Because again, he is supposed to be a depth piece. He's not supposed to be a star for us. We took him for depth purposes. If he gets 2 sacks, I'm thrilled.
Yeah, and he's got 3 years of eligibility left. So, let's say he doesn't play a lot this year. Maybe he does a special teams role. And, eventually he could work his way up into the starting lineup. We'll never know, but we'll have to see. Neil, we did have quite a few other visitors. I touched on Miles Graham. The biggest news of Miles Graham there, he truly is one of the alphas. He's pretty much the alpha on defense. We have DJ Lagway, the alpha on the offense. Miles Graham has basically said, my commitment is 100% solid. It is shut down. And I think there's some validity to it. He is a Gator legacy. He's one of the first guys to join this class. I do believe he is solid. And I think a congratulations is in order for Miles Graham, as he was rightfully awarded his 5th star by surprise. Rivals tends to be the outlet that kind of undervalues Florida commitments, at least historically they have in recent years. But today they awarded Miles Graham his 5th star and number 14th overall rating in their updated ranking. So I would look to see to hit the consensus and the composite ranking change on him a little bit here, and that should bump Florida's numbers up a little bit in the class. So congratulations to Miles Graham. Hope he has a great senior season and continues to ascend up the rankings, because I do think, based on his film, is a very special player. If you want to, now let's go through the rest of the commitments, or the visitors rather, and guys we hopefully will be committing and joining the class relatively soon. We'll start with the tight end position, Neil. We had at least 3 guys enter Gainesville, and I think there's a chance we'll get a commitment from at least one of these 3. The first is Caleb Odom. Now, a note on Caleb Odom, he has, I think the Florida staff has basically said, we're not really recruiting you as a traditional tight end. We're more recruiting you as a possession receiver. You know, he's 6'5", 6'4", depending on where you look, around 220 pounds. So he kind of is that Justin Shorter size, if you will, a guy that can go up, get the ball, has some speed. All the intel coming out of his Alabama visit last week, and even still Steve Wilfong put in a crystal ball for him to Alabama, was that he was a foregone conclusion to the Crimson Tide. That seems to have at least stopped for the time being, and now Florida may have pulled, even if not pulled ahead of Alabama, for his commitment. Now, he is said that he's probably going to make a commitment at the end of the month or in early July, where a lot of these visitors, recent visitors, have kind of started to say they're going to be making a summer decision before the football season starts. Caleb Odom is one of them, and he is somebody that I look to, if Florida can get him back on campus or they continue to push, I think ends up in the class and would fit that need of a tall possession receiver that we have. We've already taken the speedy receiver in Isaiah Williams. We're looking at taking another one of those types of receivers in Trey Hawkins, who I'll talk about in a second. We need a tall possession receiver to replace a guy kind of like a Justin Shorter or other players that we have coming up. Neil, speaking of other receivers that are potentially joining the class, we have probably the top guy now on the receiver board, and that is Chance Robinson, a current Miami commitment. Neil, you have a little bit of intel on Chance Robinson, I believe.
I do. Before I get to that, though, just breaking news as we're recording this, former Florida Gator target and Oklahoma Sooner Derek LeBlanc is in the transfer portal.
Wow.
That was considered by some to be a big miss last year, considered by many to be a target, maybe not a must get, but certainly someone on the Gators board. You talked not 10 minutes ago about, well, there's one scholarship spot left. What do you do? Well, he's from Kissimmee, Florida. Or Kissimmee, Florida. I never know how to pronounce that town. I know how it's written in
stuff. Kissimmee,
okay. I know how things are spelled. I'm not always great with pronunciations, but he's from the state of Florida. He's a home state guy, and he's in the portal as of early Monday evening. Billy, go get him. That would certainly be a nice way to round out your roster and your scholarship allotment for the 2023 season. Go get him. As for Chance Robinson, yeah, he is someone I'm friendly with. I actually haven't spoken to him directly in a little bit of time, but I've got some intel on him, and that's just that he is – it's not really intel at this point because everyone can see it on Twitter, but he is genuinely torn between Florida and Miami. This was intel. Chris can back me up on this, that I told him about this before he put it out on Twitter. So it was intel, but now it's, you know, for everyone to see. But he is genuinely torn between the Gators and the Canes. You know, he is a South Florida kid. He grew up a Miami fan. He, you know, has those dreams of returning the Canes to glory. He grew up like watching those YouTube videos of that 2001 team with Jeremy Shockey and Ed Reed and Frank Gore, you know, and all those other stars, Sean Taylor. You know, he grew up watching those YouTube videos because that's what everyone around him was indoctrinating him with. Well, you're a South Florida kid. This is what the Miami Hurricanes once did. This is the legacy of this area in college football. So he grew up with that, but the Florida Gators making a real push, and they're really giving him something to think about. They're sending him a lot more mail. They're texting him more. They're just putting more of an emphasis on him, maybe or maybe not, because of another miss that Florida had recently at the wide receiver position. But regardless, they are showing a real interest in him. They do seem to be putting a very high priority on him. Actually, I don't even know if that sentence makes sense. No, I'll say it this way. They're making him a high priority. That's the correct syntax there. They're making him a high priority. They're making him feel like a high priority. I think at this point, it's ultimately slightly greater than a coin flip that he'll stick with the Canes, probably a 55-45, maybe a 60-40 proposition, but by no means is this over. Look for the Gators to really put the press on him and you know, hopefully if the Gators can have a better season this year than they did last year, you know, no more Vandy losses, no more near catastrophes against South Florida, and Miami continues to spiral out of control like we saw them do on the field last year, that might be what it ultimately takes to him, for him to realize, look, you know, those Canes glory days are done. They're over. They're dead. You know, it's cool to watch them on YouTube. I'll always remember being enamored with them as a kid, but the business decision for me is to go to Florida. That might be how it ultimately plays out.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. And I like where the staff is. They're pushing for that commitment or that flip. And, you know, there's definitely room. There's room in this class. We need a receiver of his caliber. And that certainly would lessen the sting of losing T.J. Moore from your own backyard in Tampa. And it'd be great to flip a guy like Chance in Miami's own backyard and bring him up to Gainesville. So we'll see what happens there. We'll continue to bring you updates as that recruitment comes along. Other visitors from this past weekend, we had four-star tight end Walter Matthews out of Hiram, Georgia. This right now is viewed as a Florida-Southern Cal battle. Some people think Southern Cal might have a slight edge, but he just recently visited Florida. The visitor's high, and it's either pretty much, it's a 50-50 recruitment, I think, at this point for that one. Could go either way. Also targeting a summer commitment date, so we'll have to see there. And I think, too, it kind of depends on who joins the class, right? You know, there, Florida is looking out for a couple of other receivers outside of Walter Matthews. Next week, we have Amir Jackson, who's going to be visiting Florida. That's a guy that if he pulls the trigger, I think, or the staff allows him to pull the trigger, I think he joins the class. And then you have one tight end in there. Then they take another tight end. Florida had another visitor this past week from Illinois, Eric Carner, a three-star/four-star player, depending on where you look. He's, you know, viewed, this is viewed as an Iowa-Florida battle. Florida views him, though, as more of an H-back role, not necessarily that traditional hand-in-the-dirt tight end role. So a little bit more flexibility with his position. If Florida gives him the green light, a lot of people believe, based on his official visit this past week, he would commit to Florida. So then if you take Carner, you take Jackson, then that pretty much makes the mind up for Walter Matthews, especially if Caleb Odom comes in and takes that kind of that hybrid receiver role that we were talking about. So we'll have to see. I think overall, though, the board is really strong this year for tight end. Last year, it was a little bit questionable. I think that there was a lot more to be desired, but nonetheless, I think there's a chance for Florida to make some noise here. Visiting once again with Zay Mincy. Zay is viewed as a big-time Florida lean at this point. It's a matter of maybe when, if not if, he commits to Florida. He has all the crystal balls, all the projections on three. Say Zay is looking to commit to Florida, but we'll have to see. I think he's going to be making another summer decision soon. And Neil, that's kind of sensing a trend here. If you go back and look at 2023, Florida at this point only had three commitments last year. They had Bryce Lovett. They had Najee Harris, who ultimately signed in the class. And then they had Cree Whittemore, who flipped to Mississippi State. There weren't a lot of commitments, and if you go back and look at where the majority of the commitments came, they came in mid to late June, and they came in July and August. That's where the class was built, and then you filled it in kind of toward the end there. We brought in the transfers in the class, and then you had your 20-some-odd guys that joined the program. I think that's something we're going to see history repeat itself. It's kind of the new trend here in the NIL era. I mentioned him before, Dre Hawkins. This is a Florida-Penn State battle. It could go either way. There are some rumors out there that he may not even have – Penn State might not have room in their receiver room to take him in the class, and then by default Florida would get him. But I do think Florida could win this recruitment outright. He is from West Virginia, so obviously closer to home if he were to go to Penn State, but has been at ING Academy for the last year. And he would be another speedy receiver like that Isaiah Williams, who could add that speed to that to Florida's offense that they like. And that they've shown that they're bringing in with guys like Andy Jean, Aiden Mizell, and Trey Wilson, who will be joining the program this season. So we'll have to see. Dre Hawkins is looking to make a commitment or June 26th. So he actually has a date in mind. And that is going to be right after he visits Penn State. So we'll have to see how that visit goes. But right now, Florida has put themselves in a good position to land him. Somebody that got a crystal ball today and would bolster the defensive line after Florida took an offensive lineman in Mike Williams today. That's four-star defensive lineman Nashir Johnson, who projects in the interior side of defensive line. Blake Alterman put in a crystal ball at 6 confidence for him. This is a Florida-Florida State battle. It'd be nice to get a victory over Florida State for a prospect that they covet and they want, and also going into the state of Georgia and pulling a recruit, a blue chip recruit who has a fairly high ranking. He is a top 200 player consensus wise. This would be a really good get for Napier and the staff to get that defensive line recruiting off to a good start, especially in the interior where it's very pivotal. So we don't have to go into the transfer portal like we did this past season. A couple other names to mention: Dustin Denton Jr. He could potentially project as a safety or a corner. Corey Raymond is recruiting him at both spots, but you know, I think Florida, the fact that he's now has pushed his commitment date out shows that Florida has a good chance. He is out of Providence, Rhode Island, is long viewed as a Penn State lean, but Florida has made a really strong push here for the three-star prospect, and we'll see if he joins the class. Florida does need corners to commit, and we do have a couple of safeties, some of which could play that corner nickel role, but Denson could be at that corner role, and if Florida presses for the commitment, could get it. And then finally, we'll wrap up with two more trench players: Marcus Mascall out of South Gwinnett in Georgia. This is a Florida LSU battle. He will be visiting NC State this weekend, but many believe this is either Florida or LSU. LSU seen as the favorite, but you never know. I mean, the Florida has the need on the offensive line right now. He would be another good get to add to the room and a pretty good offer sheet to come with it. And then finally, Micah Boyeru out of Fairburn, Georgia, another Georgia prospect on the defensive line, would project as a defensive tackle. He's got plans to visit Georgia, Michigan, Ole Miss. This is a guy that has kind of started to get a little bit more buzz in his recruitment, is a three-star, a consensus three-star, but as I just mentioned, he has some pretty good offers out there. And at Florida was one of the first schools in on him. Perhaps they could press for that commitment, get him in the class before his recruitment really does start to take off. So, Neil, overall, I think the last 2 weeks, I think fans, and I think you kind of vented your frustrations. We need commitments. I think they're on the way. And just based on history, guys are going to take their visits. They're going to go through the process. We just need to stay on them throughout that process, even after they've taken those visits, either trying to get them back on campus or continuing that line of communication until the dead period in July. But I think this thing could really start to take off for Florida in the next couple of weeks, and we will start to see some of those big-time commitments, whether it is a Walter Matthews or a Chris Jones or a Dre Hawkins or even a Kendall Jackson out of Buchholz in Gainesville. We'll have to see, but I think we'll start to see Florida's numbers rise up and start to resemble what the class will actually look like come fall. So Neil, give us your final thoughts on where you think we're headed, and then we'll wrap up the show.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think Napier has shown a refusal to sign a bad take. So I think if nothing else, we can feel somewhat confident in the fact that the talent that Florida has on the field will be of a certain baseline level. There will not be someone who doesn't belong at the University of Florida playing for the University of Florida. Napier just won't do that. The issue will be, will there be enough depth of those guys? Will there be a too deep of guys that are quality takes? Because the starters are, from what we've seen from Napier so far, that's not going to be an issue. We're going to get that talent level that we need to compete. But is there going to be a too deep? And then is there going to be some of that can't miss talent, that five-star talent, that elite talent? DJ Lagway, Miles Graham, yeah, that's a great start. But you need more than two of them. You need a healthy mix of those elite, elite, elite guys and the very, very good high four-star could arguably be five stars if you just happen to, you know, watch the tape in a certain way type of guys. And only having 8 commits right now, again, is worrisome. I understand, you know, what you just said about This was the time a year ago where we had all those guys come visit. The commitments wound up coming a couple months later, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen again. If you let a Chris Jones walk off campus, go to Georgia, and he's just enamored with it all, and he commits there, that will be a bad, bad miss for Napier, because he did have him on campus. The crystal ball came in again. Those aren't just put in on a whim. There's some real intel that comes the way of those 247 analysts that makes them put those in. They don't just come because the guy feels like getting the fan base excited that day. There's real smoke for him to Florida, and he brought his parents down. So with him, a Jarae Hawkins, I think Florida has to close on too. That's another one of those guys I think could participate for the Gators pretty early on, and for a couple of years at a very high level for the Gators. So, you know, those two guys, maybe a Kendall Jackson, another one that I think is one that Florida can't miss on. You know, you just generally can't miss on Gainesville kids. I think Jarrett Gibson is going to wind up being one that really frustrates a lot of people for that exact reason. But, you know, you got to land the hometown kids and you got to land the elite kids. So those are just a couple of the frustrations I think fans have about Napier, myself included. But again, after saying all of that, I will come back to the first thing I said in this final monologue, which is Napier is not going to give us any athletes on the field that don't belong in Florida. There's going to be a certain quality of take that he will insist on getting. So we can at least rest assured that there's not going to be some of those guys that Mullen took that, you know, probably shouldn't have taken. And hence the reason for that massive roster flip we just saw this past offseason. For the second year in a row, a massive roster flip of the Gators. And finally, Chris, I guess we'll close with the thing that just broke as we were recording the pod, the Derek LeBlanc news of him entering the transfer portal. He was high school teammates with Jakeem Jackson, also high school teammates with John Walker, who is now at Central Florida. So I imagine that those two teams, both because he has teammates there and because they're both pretty close to the town he grew up in, are going to be among the favorites to land his services. But if Florida can land him, that's, I mean, he's not anywhere close to a polished product. So you can call it developmental, but that's a kid who's already a year out of high school. So at the same time, you're adding a kid who's 1 year older, 1 year faster, 1 year stronger than all these high school kids that are currently looking to commit to schools, but also quality take, finishing off the roster. I think that would be something that Gator fans would genuinely feel good about as they head into summer.
Most definitely. Well, we're going to be tracking that, the story with Derek LeBlanc as it develops, and see if there is any interest on both sides for him to come to the University of Florida. But we'll have to see. And Neil, I'm sure we'll be putting out some more content. This will drop tomorrow, but we'll be putting out some more content about the upcoming College World Series and preview yet another exciting visitors weekend for the Florida Gators. And any recruitment news, of course, that comes up hopefully in the form of commitments. Before we go tonight, I want to shout out one of our other partners, Alma Mater. If you haven't already seen them, check them out. Go on and click on our link at the top of inallkindsweather.com and shop for any sort of hats, polos, or other apparel. They continuously put out new apparel, it seems like almost by the day, and you have an opportunity to actually support our athletes and their NIL efforts by buying their merch on Alma Mater's website. So hit that link at the very top of inallkindsweather.com and buy some Alma Mater today. Well, that does it. Another episode of the In All Kinds Weather Forecast. We thank you all for listening and tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star review on our show. And be sure to follow us on all of our social medias, In All Kinds of Weather. On Twitter, we have a recruiting handle as well as the All Kinds of Weather Forecast Twitter account on Twitter. We have All Kinds of Weather on Facebook and on YouTube, and be sure to follow the In All Kinds of Weather Forecast, our new YouTube channel on YouTube as well. We're putting all of our new podcast episodes as well as some exclusive interviews and content that Neil's been dropping, one of which was the exclusive interview with our baseball team. So please go check that out. Follow, subscribe, give us a rating and review. It helps the show grow, and we can bring you more fantastic content. So with that said, have a good night and go Gators.